When I did a test run through this, it took 70 minutes. I took some slides out, but it's going to be very intensive. But most important thing is, let's start from the beginning, and I'll tell you what the most important thing is, since you're already here. So welcome to their presentation from Content to Search, Speed Dating Apache Solr. My name is Alexander Rafalovich. I'm an Apache Solr committer, and I'm an Apache Solr popularizer within the community. So my goal is to introduce Solr to the beginners and to try to get you guys understand why Solr is so awesome and to be able for you to start very quickly with the project and to understand where it can bring the most benefits to you. So I am used to do very intensive sort of presentations. Today is one of those. It's a very intensive presentation. However, it serves two purposes. One is for you to get a feel of what's possible, right, without getting burned out. So you don't get it, you skip it, you keep looking. And the second thing for this presentation to be a reference. So you can come back to that later, and there are links to documentation. There is a GitHub repository and all that stuff. I'm going to give it to you. This presentation is already online on SlideShare. So you can check it straight away. You can catch me through the rest of the day. You can look for me. I will be available for lunch. For anyone who will stay till the end of the lecture, the end of the presentation, you can have me for the next hour of the lunchtime to ask additional questions, follow-ups, and so on. So that's the way it's going to work. I'm going to be going even faster than this in a second. All right, so I'm assuming you have at least a very rough idea of what the Apache Solr is. Otherwise, you wouldn't be in this room. There is at least three competing fantastic talks. But it's basically a search engine, right? It's been around for 10 years. And it's a search engine not the way the Google search engine is, which is generic search engine searching huge amount of data, but more like an Amazon search engine is, a search engine that's tuned for your organizational needs. So it has awareness of your domain and so on. And so it has very different challenges from a Google search engine style thing. So it has advanced full text search. It's a very, very advanced. It's got faster than aggregation. It can scale gigantically. It's very configurable. It has a lot of different ways to configure it. It supports near real-time indexing. So if your data goes into main database, you can synchronize to search engine to be discoverable very sort of within seconds or less, even if you desperately need it. It can take multiple input formats, can output stuff in different ways. It has clients in different languages. It integrates quite a number of other Apache projects. We are co-located with Lucene. Solr and Lucene is actually the same project, but also many other projects very important to us. So thank you if you are a contributor or committed to any of those. We very appreciate that. It incorporates a couple of non-Apache projects, such as IBM ICU4J, which is amazing Unicode library, and a couple of other things. It does have a web-based admin UI. You will see some screenshots of that through my demonstration. It can also, in the most recent versions, can do some graph, machine learning, SQL interface to it. There is some linear algebra. There is lots of things coming in from different angles into Solr because it has very active contributors from different places. It really is the search engine that could. It's really rich. And learning Solr, we do have a lot of support material. We have a reference guide, which is more than 1,200 pages of stuff, of a lot of things. There is a wiki. I don't recommend going to wiki anymore. Google still picks up wiki. Make sure you go to reference guide. Okay, we are migrating away from wiki to the reference guide. It ships with many examples. So it's got like 10 different examples, and they have explanation of how they work, readme files, all of those things. We also have mailing lists, obviously, standard Apache practice. We have IRC channel, and we have a smaller community at Stack Overflow. In addition, there is a commercial conference that used to be called Lucene Solr Revolution. And as of this year, as of 2 weeks from now in Montreal, they have the videos on YouTube from the previous years. I also run a reference website specifically for Solr as a separate activity. I did that even before I got my commit privileges, and I continue to run it. It's a little behind the date right now. I was preparing for this, as you will see. However, too much of a good thing could be a bad thing sometimes. So Solr reference guide is feature-oriented. So some powerful features that I really believe beginners should know very early on. are a little hard to locate, right? So examples could be a bit of a kitchen sink because, you know, they grow and grow and grow and grow, and it becomes hard to navigate through them sometimes. Printed books just cannot keep up, right? There is like solar new version coming out every 6 to 8 weeks. The books take a year. It just doesn't work. So we have a couple of really good books. They're now way behind. So they're still good, but they're not up to the date. So in many examples that we do ship, have artificial tuned data sets, and there are several ways to do similar thing. So it's great, but it's also bad. So my focus today is to try to solve that, right? So what we're going to do is we're going to, and I promised you real data sets, right? So we're going to use the smallest learning configuration, not production, learning, right? I'm going to show you a couple of latest cool features from Solr that may not even have been fully documented yet. We're going to do end-to-end, the search part. And very importantly, we're going to evolve from the queries backwards, right? And we're going to use real-life example from a mailing list called Data is Plural. It's quite interesting. It comes every week. They have a couple of links to the interesting data sets. And so what you're going to have today is you're going to get a small taste, but it's a good taste. It's going to be enough for you to understand how to keep learning after this by yourself, right? And like I said, there is a repository which contains their configuration files I'm mentioning, contains the original version of this presentation, which you can reuse if you want to for any other purposes. And it's all in there, except for the data sets, which have separate license. You need to download them. Okay, so learning setup. So the minimum setup to get Solr going and for you to start learning with it is very small. I mean, it's one server. You can have one collection or core, which is the same at that point. Per example, minimal schema without extra stuff in it, and minimum configuration. From there, when you go to production, you will scale to something much bigger. You know, you could have multiple servers. You could have Solr Cloud with Zookeeper coordinating it. You can have multiple collections with shards, replicas, all these things, and a full configuration for it. And we have a reference guide that helps you to get there. I'm not talking about this today. I'm just trying to get you started. I'm just trying to get you to understand what you're looking at. Okay? So what does a rapid application development looks like for Solr? The best way I can sort of, I've been showing to people and people like it. And any of you who remember BASIC, you know, there are gaps in numbers because obviously there is lots more little steps in there. But basically, you get the server running, you create the core, you index some data, you run some queries, facet segregation, whatever it is you're trying to actually get out of search engine. Right? Because search engine is not a database. Different use cases. Right? And then if you're not happy, if you're happy, you're done. Right? And we're actually going to be happy in like about 5 minutes from now. Right? Potentially. But if you're not happy, you figure out what the improvements are, and then you do your evolution. You evolve your schema, you evolve your configuration, you you re-index the data, maybe delete what you build from scratch, and you go back, run some more queries. Are you happy now? And so on. Once you're done, you're done, right? So setting up your own server. Okay, so as I said, we have a bunch of examples. They are fully pre-configured. So they will get you running. You can use examples, but sometimes it's hard to understand what's actually happening because there is a lot of magic there. You know, we do a lot of magic for you to jump straight into like exploring it, right? So it's a magic location, magic configs. It's hard to do the same example twice, you know, like if you don't blow the previous examples and so on. And it's a little confusing to go to production from there. So we're going to set up our own server. Well, I'm not going to do it live, but I'm going to show, you know, I've gone through each step of this in preparation, obviously. So I'm just showing you how easy it is, okay? And so basically you create an empty directory. You copy one file into that, which we provide. You just copy it as basically defaults. And you start it. You go bin solr, which is a command. In slash bin, we have a couple of commands. Bin solr is the main one. Dash s, path to the directory. It starts from there. Default port is 8983. There is a couple of more ports that are offset from that. And you have the server running. That's as easy as that, right? No magic except for that one file. Okay, so what's a minimum learning config looks like? Well, it's two files. and we will use three, right? So on the GitHub, you can see what they are. I'm actually going to bring them on screen. They are that small, and I'm going to explain them, but you don't need to, you know, to take the picture of the presentation. You can just copy and paste them or download them and so on. So managed schema is where you define your fields, your field types, your unique keys, and all that stuff. You can manage it directly with API. And then the solo config is more sort of system administration file, but there are also a couple of things that are important for us. You cannot modify that file by API directly, but you have overlays and request parameters APIs, and params.json is that request parameter API file. You can modify that with API, and we will. Okay? So, next step. Create collection core. All right, well, it's also simple. Bin solo create collection name. We're going to call it DIP because it's data is plural, whatever the data set name was called. And you just say where your configuration comes from, so from that directory. Okay? So that uses API, talks to the server, creates a collection. Sroot was our server directory, so it creates a collection right under that. No magic. Right, there is a little bit of a magic. The logs by default will go to a different directory, so if you're looking for logs, that's just a little exception. And this is all, again, for learning setup, one server, no cloud, no nothing. For cloud, the config is going to be in ZooKeeper, so file system reference is not going to exist. It's going to be a little messy. So didn't fit into presentation explaining how that works. It's not difficult. You just need to be aware that when you look on the file system, your config file is not there. It's actually in ZooKeeper, and you know, you need to use API or upload, download for that. All right, so data set. Data is plural, right? So it's a, basically a guy sends a newsletter with five interesting data sets, but he's also maintaining a Google Docs spreadsheet. And so let's take that. That's our first data set, okay? So let's take that right from the Google spreadsheet, download it as TSV, as a type-separated files. My example goes to 12 of September. You can get whatever. Solr can index, as I said, multiple formats. It can index CSV, but also it can index TSV if you tell it that it's type-separated, right? I'm linking throughout the whole presentation with the references to the sections of the guides. So this is your reference part. You can come back later to the same presentation, and it gives you direct links. So that should save you like 20 hours of researching. Okay. So how do we index it? Okay, right, we have a post command. Again, that's not production. This is just sort of get you started. People take it to production, but it has limitations as a tool, but it can get you really, really far, actually. So same thing, you just go bin post to which collection, so that's deep. What's the parameter? Parameter is, you know, ASCII code 9, which is a tab, but escaped because it's a URL form. And it's a text CSV as a type, and you send a file. And it actually fails, right? So it's going to fail because it says, well, I don't know what the unique key ID is. You didn't provide it because the data set doesn't have it. It's a personal data set. It's not it's not a machine data set. Okay, fine. Doesn't matter. We're used to this. Okay, let's use a raw ID as an ID. Okay, so we pass one more parameter. Sol has that use case covered. We do that, and boom, we're actually ready for search. We just indexed a real-life data set by providing a couple of parameters to Solr to say, well, here's what my use case looks like. All right, let's go search it, okay? We're good, right? We're going well.
Like the row ID was automatically, where did you get it?
It just goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right?
Who did that?
Solr. It supports a use case that your data may not have an ID, but you may want one. So specifically for CSVs, it gives you an option to say, yeah, fine, we'll just generate one. There is another three ways to do that, if that's not quite your use case, but it takes more configuration. So you can do the signature, you can do a bunch of other things. Okay, so if you have an admin UI, as I said, it's really good to start playing with Solr and configure it and so on. So you just go to that port 8983, it redirects you to the admin UI. All right, so a couple of things I want to show you. So the URL, like I said, and then on the left, you're gonna have the core selector. So right now we have one, that's our first one. If you run something like that import handler example from distribution, it will have like five in there. So it can have very large number of cores there. So we only have one. So once you pick it, it opens up, it gives you the rest of the menus for that specific collection, that specific cores things. And query is basically where you do search. So I show where it is approximately. And we're going to keep coming back to different screens during the presentation unless we run out of time. And the easiest thing is basically that. You select your core, you go to a search screen, you click on execute query at the bottom left there, and it just gives you back all your documents. Simple, right? So that's it. That's just your start. So you can see there is like a bunch of documents with a bunch of fields. Now remember, we haven't configured the instance for this specific data set. The learning data set I'm going to explain to you actually allows you to automatically figure it all out. Not perfectly, but automatically. And you can see those generated IDs. Okay, so what does the result look like? So just to show you, so in the top right, we saw it actually gives you your UIN admin UI. So don't use admin UI URL if you want to do it, but it gives you the URL it actually generates. So you can click on that and open it in a separate window. You can right-click it and save it or whatever, but it shows you what the actual Solr query URL looks like. So that's a very useful shortcut. It tells you what the parameters are that you pass to it. Not all parameters go in a command line. We have defaults. We will see how we set them up later. And I've set it up, so it tells you what the parameters are. So you can see them. It tells you number of documents found, 605 in my example. And then it shows you, you know, it shows you the first 10 of those documents, and that's just the first example. So we have edition, position, headline, text, links, hat tips, and ID, auto-generated ID. Now, that was JSON, but in reality, you can output a lot of different formats. You can experiment them straight in admin UI. There is a drop-down for that. But this is like what we do to allow you to integrate with your clients so you don't have to. If your client is in PHP, you might as well just get PHP stuff back, PHP escaped results. If it's Ruby, you can get Ruby. So we try to make it really easy for you to integrate. So it's just a parameter. All right, well, let's do a couple of searches. We don't know why they work yet, but they do. So let's search for data. So there is a Q box, we just put data, and you can put data in all caps, you can put data in small, it all works. It gives you 461 results back on my example. And you can do slightly more complex queries, you can do very complex queries, this is just basic example. But you know, you can say data and news, so find me records that have eight of those words, find me plus data plus news, find me records that have both of those words, or that have data but not news. Okay, now the questions to keep in mind, right? Remember I said Solr is very configurable. All of this is configurable. Why do we have case insensitivity? What makes it happen? I will show you. What defines the search index? I'm not gonna go too deep into it, I will mention it. Okay, so these are kind of things you're going like, it's working, why, okay?
How come data news has more results than plus data?
Because by default, it's like a Google, the word is optional. But if you have both of those words, you get higher ranking. Okay, so that's a must, should, or should not options. Anyway, I will keep the questions to the end because otherwise we will not see the last 10 slides. Okay, so beyond search, so what else can you do? Lots of things you can do. I'm just gonna show you the most basic thing. So we are back to star, column, star, which is special syntax to say return everything. We're saying give me just one row, so just one document, and we're enabling something called facets, right? So that's aggregate counts by the individual value of the field. The field I pick is addition, and then you can see, so you can see one document returned out of 605, and then under it we have a new section called facet counts, and it shows that the guy doing the newsletter is very, very consistent. He's just doing 5 issues per week. Very consistently, he's very good, he's a journalist. He's used to the deadlines and precision. Okay, so we can get that kind of information really fast. So, you know, when you do a search on something like Amazon and it comes back and it says, under the categories, you have 5 hits in here and 3 hits in there and 2 hits in there or whatever, Solr gives you out of the box. So if you want that for your project, bang, it's there. Like, you don't need to do any calculation yourself. Solr is very, very good at these kind of things. But say you want something more complex, right? Not just field values, but say you want more queries. You can do that. So you could have facet query, which has specific syntax. You can do additional things in there. So here I said by year, right? But it's a little hard to enter this in admin UI, right? And it's also even hard to enter it as a get string because it's quite long. Fortunately, Solr accepts POST, no problem. So you can use a tool like Postman or something and just provide that as a body of, you know, URL form encoded as a body of your request. And you can see on the right that it then calculates and basically says, okay, so the project must have started somewhere in mid-2015 and been going pretty steady since, okay? All right, quick review. So what did we do? We did a basic index of a real data set. We did some samples, simple searches, and we saw the case sensitivity, we saw basic facet, and we saw slightly less basic facets, okay? So this is already useful. For many people, this is it. This is the end of the road. They're already happy if they can get that far. So, you know, you watch this in the first 10 minutes, you're done. However, I want you to understand why this works, right? Because I want you to understand how you can tune it for your projects, maybe why you want to integrate it with your projects and so on. So I mentioned minimal learning config. So we have three files. So let's now look at them. All right, well, that's a minimum Solr config, right? So that's a system administration one. And we are basically saying that Lucene version we are using is 7.4.0, right? So it knows which features to enable and disable based on the history kind of thing. And then we're defining one request handler called select. And for that one, to make it easy to use, we have a use param attribute pointing at a select sort of all caps, which matches to the one in params.json. So that allows us to use API to override those parameters easily instead of modifying the original file. So that's kind of my recommended approach to make it easy to work. Now, used to be in Solr that whatever you define in Solr config, that was the only configuration, but we moved to a lot of defaults you can override. So if you want to see what all defaults are, we have an API for that. And you just hit that and it will tell you all the rest of the things. So there is a little bit of a magic here, but I'm telling you how to see what actually is happening under the covers. Like we will tell you all the configuration is. So all the rest of the endpoints and all the different things. And you can define a lot of endpoints yourself with a lot of different parameters and defaults and all the rest of the things. All right, minimum managed schema is a little bigger. And the main reason it's a little bigger is because Solr is very explicit about configuration of the fields and the types because it believes that you may want to have it differently. So we're going to go through it step by step. And so we have here some fields, we have some types, and we have some additional syntax I'm going to explain. But before that, I just wanted to explain how Solr views this kind of information. So we have three levels of setup configuration. We have classes, which is, you know, have internal logic, and we provide those inside Solr. And we have field types on top of that, which use those classes, and may have additional configuration, especially for text-specific search. And then we have individual fields, which are actually what, you know, constitutes your documents, okay? So the most popular field type classes are string, text, we now have sortable text field, which is part of the new features, int point field, date point field, and so on. And many people kind of only know about those, but in reality, we have a lot of other classes on, you know, as well. So for different use cases, so we have binaries and booleans and collation if you have interesting sorting requirements, and pre-analyzed fields for super weird use cases, and random if you want to sort your records randomly, lots and lots of different things. So those are the parts that are kind of inside Solr and Lucene. And then on top of that, we do explicitly define the field types and the fields that use them. So let's see how we define them for our learning schema. All right, so the most basic one is a string, right? That we still need to define the type because we could do it in different ways. So here is a definition, and the name of the field type is a string. You don't need to take pictures, it's all already online, you can just copy from that, right? If you took the picture with the name of the repository, that's enough. Unless it's a picture of me, so then I can pose for you at the end, but. So the name of the field type is a string. The class is string field, like I mentioned. That's coded. We say what to do if the values are missing, because Solr really supports lots of missing values. And we enable doc values, which is a column store, fairly recent feature, but is getting more and more popular. We use it for more and more things. So you can do additional configuration on the field itself using the type, and you can override the values, some of the values here, to sort of fine-tune it and so on. For this particular class, string field, we don't have any analyzer magic. And analyzer magic is what gives Solr its very advanced search capabilities. We're going to see that in a second. We're going to see a very basic thing. So that's right next. So text basic is a very, very, very basic example of where we have the analyzer magic. Okay? It uses sortable text field, ignore position increment gap, not going to even explain it, and it has an analyzer. It allows the analyzer. So the analyzer is basically two steps. We are saying both for indexing and for querying, because we treat that as two different things, but here we do give the same definition. For both, in both those situations, when the text come in, tokenize it on white spaces and punctuation and stuff like that. So break the long text into individual tokens, right? And then lowercase them, right? Lowercase them during indexing. So the indexed version of this text will be tokenized and lowercased, and during query. So that's what gives you the speed, because separate from the database where you try to do lowercase bracket field value, it doesn't lowercase what's your indexed every time you do the search. It pre-does the work, because you're saying my use case is that my users probably will be searching lowercase, uppercase. So Solr has a lot of configuration to enable you to do exactly that, to say, what is it that I'm expecting people to do? Let's build a use case for that into the configuration to make it easier for you. So there is lots and lots of different analyzer chain and examples, like hundreds, and you can, and in some cases should, craft your own for specialty use cases. Okay, so now let me explain to you what it looks like. So I'm not gonna explain the whole dictionary pointing thing structure. There are other presentations for that. I'm just gonna show you. If you have an analysis screen, that's really helpful for that. So you feed the text in, you see it's capitalized, there are dashes, there are other things, there are exclamation marks, and then it shows what happens as it goes through the analyzer chain. So at the first step, it splits it into tokens, and in the second step, it lowercases them. And then during the query, it does the same thing, and then if the tokens match, that's your match to the record in a very, very basic form. So that's kind of what's happening behind the scenes. So that's where the speed comes from, because it creates those pre-indexed, those index structures to do these kind of things fast. Okay, so let's look at the fields themselves. So ID field, right? It's of type string, so there is no magic there, no analyzing magic. We're saying that it's required, that's kind of rare, but it's an ID field. And it's both indexed and stored. Don't have to be. Can do one or another, can actually ignore both, can not index and not store, which is useful if you have stuff coming in and just you just want to ignore it, just so it doesn't blow up your schema. Okay? And the reason it's an ID, the reason it's required and it's not ID is not because it's called ID, but because we have a separate record that says unique key is ID. So that's your primary key, basically, in the database terms. So we need to declare that. So we do. Okay. So let's take slightly more interesting one. It's called underscore text underscore. There is no semantic meaning, but we're kind of using it to show that for us it means something special. We'll see why special later. And it's of type text basic, so it does get lowercase and split and all the rest of the things. It can be multi-valued, and it is indexed, but it's not stored, okay? And it's not doc-valued. By default it would be, but we're using this field in a slightly funny way, so I'm going to explain why. All right, and then we have a dynamic field definition. So the previous definition was an explicit definition. We gave it a name. This one is a pattern-based definition. So it says if I have a field and it doesn't have explicit definition, but it matches a regular expression, a pattern, not a full regular expression, this one just a star thing, then it will match that and it will automatically generate the field for it on the fly. And that's basically what happened in our example, right? We fed the data, it matched against that, and all of those fields, they will be stored, and they will be indexed, and they will be tokenized, and so on. So the user will see them and things. And finally, to complete our learning schema, we have a copy field. And that basically copies the content from one field into another. And you would use it quite frequently because you may want to process something in two different ways, and so and match it in several different ways. So we are copying all the fields, right? And this is also all dynamic fields and ID field to the field underscore text underscore. So remember that that text field is searchable, right? But it's not stored. So we copy a bunch of things into it, but it's not going to be shown back to the user. We're going to be using it internally. And it's multi-valued, so we can copy a bunch of things into it. So that's how it all connects. The important part, which some people get caught on, is that when you copy stuff, like if you copy from an integer into a string field, it gets processed in that field, it gets processed by the target field definition, so as a string. So if you copy dates into a text field, it gets searched as a text. Now, the main question is, why do we need this duplication? Like, why do we actually need to copy fields? Well, let's go back to the query, right? So what happened when we search for that plus data minus news? You can enable a debug flag to find out. It will give you a lot of information. One of those things is going to be a parsed query. The parsed query say what you're actually doing, right, is you're searching in the field underscore text underscore for the word data, and in that same field for the word news, and one is plus and one is minus. So Solr has a query parser, right? So when you enter your query, it goes into a query parser, it has parameters. So in solrconfig.xml, we define that the only endpoint we defined explicitly was slash select. And it said that we're using param select. And there we had a specific parameter called df in text. By default, if you don't override it, the Lucene query parser, which is what we ended up using here, expect this parameter. And that parameter says that's where you search if you don't do anything more smart. So if you just put the text in and doesn't know where it should be searching, it all searches against one field. So you need to give it that one field, which is what we did. However, you have lots of different query parsers, right? EDSMAX is very popular. It allows you to search across multiple fields and give different fields different weightings, you know, so you can copy field and search against multiple fields that process the same information in different ways and give different rankings and so on. So you may get like a million of results, but the first page will look fantastic. So you get relevancy because that's where most of the magic comes from. And we also have a lot of additional query parsers for geo information, for more specific matches, for specific syntaxes and so on. So this is a part that many of the people don't recognize. They kind of think it comes with something, that something parses it, that's the only way. It's not. Solr gives you all these different ways, and there is a lot of options to do that. Okay, so let's have a quick look at what actually happened with a specific record and why it matched. So because you saw in the schema, I didn't define anything but ID and underscore text underscore and the dynamic field. So the dynamic field matched everything. So if you look at the headline field, for example, and we go into schema screen in admin UI, I promised you we're going to look at multiple of them. So when you pick that field, it says, oh, it's here because it's a dynamic field, match the definition star. And the type of the field is sortable text field. And under it, you can click on the load term info, and it actually shows you the tokenized version, the indexed version of that field. So sometimes it helps to understand what happens there. You can see, oh, what does the actual tokenized representation, index representation looks like? The stored representation is still what you fed it, but the index representation can look wildly, completely different because that's your goal. Your goal is to create index representation that allows you to find stuff, right? Okay, so let's say if we were happy at this point, we're done. But let's say we're not happy, right? I've got time to fill. So we're going to do more interesting things. Let's say our if condition has failed and we're going back. And so let's say we want links as multi-valued strings split on white space, right? So during the ingestion. So we want those links to be, to be able to see those links individually and maybe do some things on them. Okay, so we still only have Now, remember, in our, because we use dynamic fields, it didn't modify the schema itself. It did the matching right during the ingestion of the, like when the data was coming in, but the schema is not modified, right? So it didn't create the definitions. So, but we can create the definition and we can say what to do with that field explicitly. That's our more unique requirements. Great. Okay, so go in admin UI, delete the links definition. Don't really need it to delete in this particular case, but still good idea. Create explicit definition. So we're saying, okay, links, we want it to be strings, we want them to be stored, we want them to be indexed, and we wanted them to be multi-valued. Okay, so then we need to re-index, okay? When we create the explicit definition, the admin UI will use the API to talk to Solr, and that will rewrite managed schema. So when that will happen, you will lose all the comments. So if you're playing with examples and you modify the schema, make sure to read the comments before you did that. So that's kind of one of those little things. I didn't give you any comments in there, so it's fine. Sometimes you need to delete stuff and reindex. Sometimes you can just reindex. Depends on how much you modified stuff. Okay, but if you do need to delete it, you know, it's just a call, so how do you do it? Okay, that's one of the ways to do it. So you can post a command and say, okay, that's my delete query. You can do it by query or by value. You can do it in XML or JSON. We have special formats for XML and JSON sort of command language. You can also do it in admin UI. So if you don't want to go back to command line or if it's a different server or whatever, you can just do it from admin UI. And as long as you choose Solr command, you can do it. And I gave you two different syntaxes for the same thing. One is XML and one is JSON. So JSON is a little easier to type by hand. Okay, let's go back and reindex. And now we add additional parameters. So we already had the row ID and the separator. And now we're going to use additional functions available to say, oh, it's a CSV. We know some stuff is multi-valued. Let's split it on a space, escape for the URL escaped space. And bang, you can see that now the same record. So links is now multi-valued, right? So it's got three links in there. So that's a lot easier on the eyes, really. Okay, good. Let's get further with that same thing. Let's find the records that have more than three links. So now we want to count them. Now it's quite hard to do if you're not prepared for it because we're not scanning through every record. We look at the, you know, at the token matches and then find the records, and then scanning is kind of expensive. So the correct reasoning when you use Solr project, when you have the use cases, remember I said work back from the search, from the queries. We're saying, oh, we're going to have a use case where we may want to count the links. Okay, right? Let's pre-calculate that. Okay, so, and we can duplicate an index in multiple ways, and we can do it in several different ways. And in Solr, often you will denormalize a record. So if you're coming from a database world where they like third standard normalized form, fifth normalized form, whatever it was, I don't remember my Dale book anymore. In Solr, you're kind of going to go in opposite direction. Often. All right, how do we do that though? So we want to pre-calculate stuff, but we want to pre-calculate it before it hits a schema. So we have update request processes, which are really powerful and are really hard to discover when you look in documentation. It's three levels deep in a sort of hidden portion of the documentation. So I'm telling you about it now so you know it exists. So when you hit the more complex use cases, you're like, oh, that's how it works. So the important part is they run after the format is parsed. So whatever format your stuff is coming in, if it's coming in from a client, it's coming in through CSV, it's coming in through XML, through JSON, doesn't matter. That's get handled before the update request processes, before the URPs are run. But they themselves hit before the schema. So if your schema is expecting an integer, but the stuff that's coming in is a text, it doesn't matter. The URP can still process it and deal with the stuff as long as after it, it's the right format for the schema. And you can run multiple of them in the chain. So you have this whole middleware kind of thing. And those of you who may have used Solr have seen or you use Elasticsearch, know the schemaless type, which is automatically guesses a field type based on the data content. All it is a bunch of update request processes defined in solrconfig.xml. That's all it is. We don't, Elasticsearch sort of hardwires that in. We don't bother, we just do it as a configuration. So for example, if you want different data types from the ones that it automatically picks up, you just go into definition and you change that. You have that flexibility, or you can update, add additional steps, remove the steps, all this stuff. For us, that's just config, okay? All right, so what do we do with counting links? Okay, well, to count links, we're gonna do two steps. One is we're going to copy the content into another field, and then we're going to basically count in place and replace it that way, okay? To define update request processes, some of them are implicit, but not these ones. You can define them in solarconfig.xml, but then you have to reload the core, or if it's in the cloud, you have to upload it and so on. Or you can use config API. So I've set this example, I've set this learning schema to allow you to do the config API. 10 minutes, wow, okay. So you can use curl postman, or you can hack admin UI. So we probably will run out of time. So those who will stay till the end can have me for lunch, or can be with me for lunch, more specifically. So in admin UI, you change the request handler to /config. You say it's a solo command, and you define your two update processors, not yet the sequence in which they are. Okay. Notice the JSON to do that is a little ugly because it's two keys that are identical, but that's limitation of JSON. Okay. So once you've created that in a different part of admin UI, we actually tell you the files that are part of your configuration, you can go and cross-check that it happened. So that's kind of useful to verify if you think you've updated something but it's not working, you can actually check that it's correct. Okay. So our sequence will generate a links count field. We want to make it an integer. And so we're going to add another type. So do a very similar thing. I showed you how to do it before in admin. I'm showing now how to do the same thing as API. So First I need to add a field type. Remember, we didn't define a type for the integer. You have to define it explicitly. There is no admin UI for that, but you can send API and create that. So after you do that, then you can actually create a field for it in admin UI. So once you've done that, again, you rerun your indexing command, but you need to say in which order you're going to run your processors, because I didn't show you any other way. This is the easiest way while you're still experimenting it. But this line is getting kind of long. Can we do something about it? Well, we can, because these are parameters to a particular endpoint. The parameters to an endpoint, we can ask Solr to store it. We already showed you parameter.json. We can put it there. So we can put it inside solarconfig.xml by hand, but we can also use the API for that. So request parameter API, I'm showing you how to do it on the right side. Notice that we had to switch the escape from URL escape to the JSON escape for tab and space, so it's /t instead of %09. So that beat me the first time I did this example. And now you can... now our parameter line is much shorter. We just say use the params deep index. And you can even remove that to make it hard-coded, but I think it's actually nicer this way because you can have multiple sets and all these different things. Okay, so that would run. Okay, so now once we do that, we can say links count should be arranged from 10 to 0 to star, which means 10 or more. And we want to sort it by the number of links. We can do that because it's integer, so it will treat that as integer and allow us things to do. And it says, okay, I found 6 records with more than 10 links. Here is the first one that has 14 links. So we can start doing these kind of things. Okay, so we are done with the first data set. Okay, but I promised multiple. I don't have time to do 3, but I can do 2. Okay, so let's search in that data set, find something else. And we're going to do the same thing faster. So let's search dogs Australia. I'm Australian by passport, and who doesn't like puppies? So fine, we find a data set, right? So let's grab the one from Australia and download that as an XML. It gives you a couple of options. Okay, let's look what it looks like. So now that we know what the options are, we can kind of compress a couple of steps. You need to reformat the XML because it's ugly, but now that you reformatted, you can see it's definitely not a Solr format. It's just XML coming out. You can pre-process that outside of Solr to fit into Solr requirements. You can pre-process it actually with XSLT inside of Solr. That's like nobody knows it exists, but it's still there from 10 years ago. You can do that. Or you can use something called Data Import Handler, which allows custom field mapping. It can do data merge. It can do nested requests. It has admin UI screen to make it easier. It's good for a quick analysis. We definitely don't recommend it for production. It was kind of a learning tool. It doesn't run too well in the cloud. But to get started, to really understand, to get to the searches and figure out what you actually need to do, it's quite nice. It's quite nice. Has limitations. Okay. So let's figure out what we actually need to do. All right, so our response, our records, are in the response role. I don't know why role, but whatever. Underscore ID is an attribute that we want to use for our ID. The rest is elements. We want to extract those. Animal types turned out to be can be D and a cat. That's not consistent. Let's normalize that somewhere. Some elements have extra space. Let's clean that up, trim it. Age should be a number, so we could do our numeric analysis. And primary color, if you can see in black tan, can have mixed colors, so two colors and so on. Could we make it possible to search on the part of a color, on the subcolor effectively? And of course, we want to lowercase everything because users are not expected to be perfect in that. So that's kind of where we want to get. So let's define the pipeline now that we know what's possible. So in the data import handler, we're going to parse the XML and we're going to map the XML elements and attributes to the field names. In the process, we want to rename some of them, you know, the way we want. In update request process, we're going to trim extra space. We're going to normalize D to dog. In a schema definition, we're going to do the same learning schema as before as a base. And then we want explicit int field for age. And then we want to do some trickery with primary color so we can do advanced searches on that. So we can involve that one step at a time, starting from data import handler definition. Totally no time for that. Can be your homework. You can email me if you get stuck. But I recommend you basically enable data import handler first so you can start getting the data in and playing with that, like in that order. Anyway, the final version of the schema, it's all on the GitHub. But you start by minimal directory, so same one we used for learning schema. And then we're going to do additional things. So in the schema, okay, we're going to use all the definition from before. We're going to add new parts anyway in the file. It doesn't care. And we want to add a type, integer type, and we want to add an age. Okay, done. Those two. We have a default of 0 because not every record may provide an age, just in case. All right, slightly more complex thing. Let's have a look. So this is using text field because we're not planning to facet on it or whatever, though we could. And here we have two definitions. We have an index and we have a query time. So now I'm doing asymmetric processing. Okay? So during the index time, I want to use keyword tokenizer factory, which does not split the text on space because our colors don't have space. We just take them as one token. And then we're going to do something, word delimiter filter factory, which has a lot of options to manipulate things like product IDs and things like Wi-Fi with dashes or not dashes or whatever, and tries to normalize them. And we're going to use a very small part of it, and we're going to say split on case change because the colors were camel cased. So we're going to use that as our breakpoint. And we're also going to keep original color, so combined color as well, in those cases where it's not a camel case sort of combination. So it will give us all the options. And then we're going to lowercase. During the query, we don't need to do any camel case breaking, right? If they're going to enter it as a proper name, we're going to match it on the original. If they're going to enter a subpart, we're going to match it on the subpart. So there, we just say, keyword tokenize, lowercase. We do less work, okay? So that's going to be very efficient, okay? So we need to define a new field split color, and we're going to copy stuff into that with a copy field. And so once we... So the original primary color is still going to have whatever it has, and then we copying for separate processing. The important part is that to search for it using the split colors definition, you need to search against split color, right? If you're doing the generic search, you're not going to match it because that's using the definition of the underscore text underscore field, which doesn't have that magic, right? And we define that field as stored equal false. So we're not storing those colors second time. We're not returning them to the user. It's really, it's just a behind the scenes, extra special search kind of field. That's what we're doing as a trick. Okay, so I'm not gonna explain how data import handler works. We ship an example. We ship 5 different examples. The specific one that's cleaned up and it's most relevant to us is called Atom. It imports Stack Overflow question and answers about solar. So that's, you know, a good live example. I'm just going to mention that there is a little bit of a configuration because it's a extra component, so you need to load it as a library and you need to mention it and it has its own config file and so on. And in that example, it shows a slightly different way to define the update request processors, which is slightly less flexible, so you see it two different ways. Okay, but otherwise, it's like 90% match to what we want to do here. So it loads stuff from the URL, we load it from the file, and they're also using transformers, which is yet another place you can do some text transformation. We're not going to use those. We're going to use update request processors. So that's what our solarconfig.xml extra part is going to look like. We define the library. We define the additional request handler, has to be with that name. You know, we say where the config is, and we tell the two update request processors, like we hard code them how we're gonna use them. So to trim stuff and to fix the dog terminology, you can see we're using a particular regex explace processor factory. The main thing is what the import, the config XML looks like for. Okay, well, we got lunch after. Yeah. You can walk out if you want, but if you'll stay, you can have me. You can be with me for lunch.
Like we have to buy you lunch.
Yeah, sure, you can do that. You know, that works too. But anyway, I'm nearly done. So we are basically, yeah, we get the file, we say where the data comes from, we are mapping attribute IDs to IDs, and we are mapping everything else explicitly, but we're renaming dsext to remove the underscore just to make it easier. Okay? And then we're back to our standard procedure. We create a core with that new configuration file, right? And then if you mess it up, you can delete the core and then create it again. So, okay. So as I mentioned, we have admin UI for that. So you go into admin UI, you run it. I recommend you enable auto fresh status so it keeps checking, going, are you done yet? Are you done yet? Are you done yet? Like those children in the backseat. And then when it finishes, it says, okay, it's done. We imported 56,000 documents. All right, so we can go search, and we can do the search, and we can search, say, for poodle, and we only return the first record of 1,700 that it found out of 56,000 total. We want to show facets on primary color field, and do not return facets with zero match documents, because otherwise it will like tell you every term it found, and with all zero counts, so it's a really good thing. So all of this you can do in admin UI. You just put things in relevant places. You can review later how to do it. It's also in the URL there as actual parameters. Okay, let's test our new field. Let's look for a puppy of the Merle color. Here is a puppy. Everybody laughs, claps, I don't know. Everybody likes puppies. Okay,
so. Everybody likes cats.
The cat was not as good as an example. I tried that. Merle is a color. There were no Merle cats. There are several types of Merle. Can we figure out what types they are and how popular they are? Okay, so now we are searching specifically against split color. We say it's Merle, lowercase. We don't actually want any documents. We do want facets. We want a facet on primary color, not split color, right? And we're saying just return one. And it goes, okay, blue Merle is the most popular. Then we have just Merle, and then we have red Merle. Okay, so you can extract that kind of analytics, and that's nothing. This is just the tip of the tip of the tip of the iceberg that Solr allows you to have. So I'm going to have one more query that is a little more complex, and then we're going to be done. And I know there are no displays for like plus 10 minutes. Okay, but I showed you the most basic things, but we also have the request API, I know. And the query DSL and JSON facets, and you can do all of this stuff. And once you go into that, into more recent functionality, you can do multi-leveled facets, you can do analytics, and we even have start of semantic knowledge graph. Like, there is a lot of cool stuff, and you can do very complex queries. And some of the job sites that you, career builder, is using Solr to do the incredibly complicated queries to do magic matches on the job names and so on. So that's, and their guy has, is now working on Solr full time. So that's what a complex JSON query looks like. So I showed you super basic ones. I'm jumping straight ahead. I'm doing a multi-level query, and I'm basically saying, for all animals with a variation of a gray color, but only of those between age 0 and 20, because we had some messy data in there, so we clean it up, show first two records and facets, and then facet by animal type, within that facet by breed, and within that show the age counts, sorry, show the number of documents for each five-year brackets, and then show some additional stuff and show average age and so on. And so it takes a little while to figure out how to define that query, but you can do it. It's one query, you feed it to Solr, and I'm showing you a tiny portion of that. I'm showing you right off the top, it says I found 3,168 total records, right? And then we have buckets within that. On for the cats, we had 1,800 of those with average age of 6.6 something something. And then within that, within the cats, we broke down by breed and domestic, short hair, I think. There was 95 of them with average age of blah, blah, blah. Within that, between 0 and 5, we had 387 of those. Within that breed, within that type of animal, 5 to 10 and so on. And on the right-hand side, you see sort of a beginning of the same record for the dog from the beginning to the end. So you can do more complex things. And I'm done. And now we can do questions. Okay? But not here.
In the restaurant.
Well. Sorry, how do you do? Can you do bitwise operations on Solr field? Yeah. Well, you can certainly define custom types. I mean, the whole thing is an open source. You can do that. I remember somebody asking a question like that and somebody giving an answer to that, but I don't remember what it would be. But my question really would be what your use case is, because... Yeah, right. So yes, the question often comes up in a sort of bitwise comparison for the users and groups managing. And there is a sister Apache project called Apache Manifold, Manifold CF, I believe, which supports that security layering on top of Solr. And they talk to Solr, and then they provide integration with enterprise content management systems and similar. And they provide specific security sort of parameters, because it's not just a bit matching, it's inclusion groups, exclusion groups, all this messy stuff. So you can hack it in Solr, right? We have different options, but it will be more of a hack. So often you find that that use case goes together better with the rest of the enterprise use cases, and that's better handled actually up downstream from Solr in, we have other Apache projects for that. Right.
So in my Solr system, can I say delete all campaigns which are more than 2 years old, so that you know, I don't use up storage and don't show all the results?
Sure, you have multiple choices with that. One is you can actually have a multi-collection, you can have an alias that actually has multiple connections backing it. So you can have campaigns per year stored, each one of them stored in separate core. And then when you want to search everything, you say combined. And when you want to search just 2 years, you just want to say, give me the last 2 years collection. So that's one option. The second option, you can have auto-expiring stuff. That's a recent feature. The third option, you can, yes, you can do a delete query. That's a query, and you say anything older than 2 years. The fourth option, I can probably give another two or three. Yes.
So
The short answer is yes, you absolutely can do a database search and either delete them or split them out or whatever. We also have time series data coming in. There is a couple of features coming in a really recent version of Solr I haven't explored that do automatic collection creation based on time series data coming in continuously. It just sort of keeps building the thing. You can do that, yes. You define an alias that points to the things, and you can even redefine the alias to have rotational next thing. So you could say as a year passes in, your endpoint is last 2 years, but that last 2 years maps to two different collections that you can change the alias on the 1st of January if you want, or whatever. Yes, all of that is there. I don't know, but what I do know is David Smiley is a person who is implementing that. So if you look at the release notes for the latest version and you search specifically for his contributions, or just look at the latest release notes, the stuff he's adding in seem to be specifically for time series in like recent version, like 7.5 just released yesterday. So that's where I would look, okay? Yeah, I had a slide for that. It was slide number 3. I took it out. Frenemies. Is it frenemies? You know, there is a term right now. They're friends and enemies. They're both using Lucene as a core engine. The developers from Solr and from Elasticsearch work together on the Lucene part. So they're friends. We all drive features together. You know, there is no animosity. However, so they all support the search use cases. But they have different focus, right? So Solr focuses a lot more on a pure text search. Elastic focuses a lot more on a sort of data search, log search, competing with Splunk. But one biggest difference is Elasticsearch is a commercial product.
Any tech people here from Travel Systems? Okay, continue.
Yeah, well, we are well over time, but yeah. Thank you for the permission. It's a commercial product. So you're going to have commercial license if you want to go to production. So then you need to compare pairs to pairs, not pairs to apples. And the pairs to pairs comparison is not Elasticsearch with Solr. It's Elasticsearch with Lucidworks Fusion, which is another commercial product from a company that uses Solr under the covers and has different UI, you know, has advanced UI, has advanced schema composition, has Spark integration, has all these other things, and has a conference here in 2 weeks. And I'm actually wearing their T-shirt. So I'm not working for that company. I'm not speaking on behalf of any company today, so just Apache. But that's kind of the thing. So you need to understand is that consulting companies work with both. They're saying we can get either of them to do any of those things, especially now. 3 years ago it was different, but now. But if you want to really truly compare, you compare commercial products to commercial products. Okay? That's how it works. Any more challenging questions? Actually, if you listen to Feathercast, I had a Feathercast on Tuesday, so audio like 13 minutes. They asked that question as well. So thank you for, I had time to prepare for it. Like the limits, you mean?
Not limits, like kind of what do you see in production? Like, you know, how big are the systems?
Well, my focus is beginners. My focus is you guys, right? So I focus on the horizontal explanation of Solr so you know what the pieces are. However, I will give you one anecdote. So I was at the Solr Lucene Revolution a couple of years now. I think it was 2015. And one of the keynotes, a girl came up on the stage. And she said, I cannot tell you which product we're using Solr for, but I work for Apple. So let's talk about the 1,000 node distribution, right? So I cannot tell you which product she didn't tell me to work on, but the word Apple Cloud comes to my mind, you know, all that stuff. Right, and they basically hired the main Solr contributor for like 6 months, Shalin. And he was getting like, each case I have a multi-thousand node solar thing and one of them does not come up fast enough and then causes catastrophic failure across like power grid style thing, let's fix that. So it scales. It scales to a lot of nodes, right? So I think, I'm not gonna tell you specific numbers, but millions of documents per node is kind of meh, whatever. Yeah, but it really depends what your document looks like. You know, if you're storing a lot of stuff, remember, Solr is not a database. It doesn't have ACID. It has different semantics around commits, you know, all that stuff. So worst case scenario, you can mark all of your fields index only. And your space requirements are just basically your dictionary tables, right? And then you return back an ID, and you use that ID to look stuff up in your original database. You have that use case if you want, right? Especially if your data is nested, complex, cross-relational, and whatever. Solr is built for search. It's more flat. You want to denormalize your data and all that stuff. So you have lots of options, right? You don't, you know, you can return data from Solr, but really, it will be a lot more efficient if you can actually avoid that. If that's your issue, if you're hitting the limitation of storing everything, you can do tricks around from there, like you have evolution from there to do other things. Okay? Anyone wants to go have lunch?